Native Americans push for better access to voting. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck. And that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us about a lawsuit charging the Montana Highway Patrol with racial profiling. And in our feature interview, news director Sally Mock talks with a New York Times reporter who has written a best-selling book about greed and vanity in Washington, D.C. A group of Native Americans is pressing ahead in its effort to force officials to provide satellite voting on Montana reservations. Former U.S. District Judge Richard Siebel last year denied an emergency order to provide satellite voting in Montana's Blaine, Rosebud, and Bighorn counties. Siebel has since retired from the federal bench after forwarding a racist joke about President Barack Obama on his official email account. 16 Native Americans are suing Montana's Secretary of State and election administrators in those counties on the grounds that members of the Northern Cheyenne, Crow, Assiniboine, and Gros Ventre are facing a long drive to the county seat. The plaintiffs say widespread poverty on those reservations means most tribal members can't make the 100-plus mile round trip because they lack vehicles. The 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals takes up the appeal tomorrow in Portland. Brett Healy is a consultant with Four Directions, a not-for-profit Indian voting rights organization that funded the lawsuit. Healy says the complaint maintains there's a blatant lack of in-person, late registration, and absentee balloting opportunities in the affected counties.
Under the Voting Rights Act and under the 14th and 15th Amendments of the United States Constitution, you can't restrict the right to vote on account of race or color. That's the law of the land, and that is the core issue in this voting rights case, is that by demanding that those residents of Hayes and Lodgepole on the reservation not only have to travel all the way to Chinook, Montana, to get the same in-person absentee voting, that for the last 30 days of the election, the only way they can register to vote is to go to Chinook, Montana. So the differential and, of course, poverty and access to vehicles plays a role, but a lot of this simply gets down to miles.
In his ruling last year, former Judge Siebel said the plaintiffs may indeed have fewer opportunities to access elections offices, but he added they also failed to prove they can't elect candidates of their choice. Healy says Siebel should not have even heard that case.
He's got a problem with race. He was forced to retire because of his problems with race. Secondly, the ridiculous standard that he articulated was one, of course, was put forward by the defendant counties, is suggesting that you could have a law that said every other Indian got to vote. But as long as there was enough Indians to vote to effectively give the candidate of, quote, the Indian's choice an election, that you could not prove inequality and could not prove a case under the Section 2 of the Act. One's articulating a standard that's wrong on the law. And in fact, it's not just us saying it. That's the Department of Justice of the United States says as much. So does the ACLU. So does the National Congress of American Indians.
Attorneys for the defendants tried to get the appeal dismissed on the grounds that last year's election has passed. The Ninth Circuit denied the request.
And in other news from around the state, a group focused on the rights of immigrants in the state is suing the Montana Highway Patrol, alleging racial discrimination. The Montana Immigration Justice Alliance claims the Highway Patrol has in place a policy of checking the immigration status of Latino drivers during routine traffic stops. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us the group believes the practice is unconstitutional.
The Montana Immigrant Justice Alliance is claiming Montana Highway Patrol troopers have been acting as de facto immigration agents. President of the alliance and lead attorney Shahed Hawk Hausrath says it's been going on for years. Troopers would pull over a Latino driver as part of a normal traffic stop.
Speeding, usually, sometimes issues with license plates.
The stop, though, it wouldn't just end with a ticket or a warning. Hawk Hausrath says the driver would be detained while the trooper checked to see whether that person was in the country illegally, often based on race alone.
Oftentimes calling offices with the Department of Homeland Security and making people wait, sometimes over an hour, while they checked on their immigration status.
The lawsuit alleges this practice has been going on for years, going on with top Highway Patrol officials not only knowing about it, but with the endorsement of at least two former MHP chiefs. Former Chief Kenton Hickathier resigned this summer after a personnel complaint saying he told an officer to detain or arrest people who might be in the country illegally. Highway Patrol officials say they are still reviewing the lawsuit and are not providing comment right now. The suit has four plaintiffs who were detained by the Highway Patrol. The lead plaintiff is a Latino man who is an American citizen, but the other three actually were undocumented immigrants. Hawk Hausrath says it doesn't matter. Montana Highway Patrol troopers need specific probable cause.
Officers have detained people just based on their race or physical appearance on a hunch that maybe they're here without status, without even knowing for sure that they are, much less that they've committed a criminal immigration violation.
Hawk Hausrath says the lawsuit is not seeking monetary damages, but is asking the courts to declare the policy unconstitutional and stop the Highway Patrol from doing it anymore. The suit was filed in U.S. District Court in Butte. The Highway Patrol has to file an answer to the lawsuit in the next couple of weeks. Montana is not the only state debating the legality of immigration status checks during routine traffic stops. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
The condition of a University of Montana employee injured in a fall while working on the roof of the campus heating plant yesterday has been upgraded to fair. Heating plant supervisor Mike Burke was injured when he fell through a skylight and landed on a boiler. University spokeswoman Peggy Kerr says the university has asked the state labor department to assist in the investigation of the accident. Two safety consultants will arrive on campus tomorrow as part of that investigation.
A former Missoula County jailer has filed two grievances alleging a hostile and unsafe work environment at the county jail, where he says inmate abuse, employee favoritism, and workplace violence are common. The grievances were filed with Sheriff Carl Ibsen and Captain Jason Kowalski by former jail guard Tim Boileau, who ended a 15-year career at the jail last month. The Missoulian reports Boileau's grievances claim a mentally ill woman had her hands cuffed behind her back for 19 hours in December 2012, that several allegations of abuse by a sergeant dating back to 2009 were not addressed, while another jailer lost his job for lesser infractions. Ibsen said yesterday the department has begun another review of allegations of inmate abuse, but won't look into those that are, quote, years and years old.
Three game wardens have filed a lawsuit against the Montana Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, arguing they should be paid for every hour they work on an undercover case because they have to maintain their undercover identities during the entire assignment. The lawsuit, filed in district court in Helena on Friday, argues the men are required to have nearly constant contact with the suspect and may set up hunting camp near the suspect or share a house, lodge, or room with a suspect. During this time, they argue, they cannot contact family members for fear of blowing their cover and rarely get a full night of uninterrupted sleep. The Independent Record reports the wardens claim FWP is retaliating against them by refusing to assign them new undercover work.
A Kalispell man whose flight from police in a stolen car ended with a woman holding him at gunpoint has been sentenced to 15 years in prison. The Daily Interlake reports 27-year-old Jordan Lynn Elliott called District Judge Ted Olympus corrupt yesterday after the judge sentenced him to 25 years in prison with 10 suspended for felony theft, assault with a weapon, and assault on a police officer, along with the revocation of two prior sentences in drug cases. On January 3rd, Elliott led police on a high-speed chase in a stolen car and ended up crashing into a police car in the parking lot of a gas station and fled. A couple that had been listening to the chase on a police scanner held Elliott for officers.
Some tourists to Yellowstone National Park are complaining about their treatment by National Park Service rangers when the park was closed down last week because of the partial federal shutdown. One tour guide operator went so far as to say rangers used, quote, Gestapo tactics, end quote, in the treatment of his tour group. Pat Viancourt of Salisbury, Massachusetts, was a member of the tour group. She says some foreign members of the group felt they were under arrest because armed rangers ordered them confined to the lodge when the park was closed October 1st. Yellowstone spokesman Al Nash says rangers didn't confine guests to the lodge, but prevented them from getting close to Old Faithful Geyser and other park attractions.
A federal judge says the government shutdown is not a good enough reason to postpone a hearing in Reno tomorrow in a fight between the Interior Department and wild horse advocates over hundreds of Mustangs gathered from a wildlife refuge on a Nevada-Oregon line. Justice Department lawyers asked U.S. District Judge Miranda Due for a stay in the proceedings until Congress restores both agencies' appropriations. Horse advocates claim it's a ploy to keep them from securing a court order to stop the shipment of animals to Mississippi to a Mississippi contractor they say has a history of reselling them for slaughter. The judge didn't address that claim, but ruled the critics have a right to argue for their First Amendment right and have access to the horses to ensure their safety before shipment.
Megan Wenk spent 3 months planning her dream wedding at Yellowstone National Park's Artists Point. Then the government shutdown closed all the national parks to visitors, leaving Wenk and her husband-to-be, Corey Hammerbeck, scrambling to find a new location for Sunday's ceremony. It didn't matter that her dad is the park's top official. Yellowstone National Park Superintendent Dan Wenk said today he and his daughter are scouting new wedding locations north of the park near the Gallatin National Forest. He says the wedding will still go on, with 65 guests expected to arrive from across the nation. Wenk says it won't be the wedding his daughter had hoped for, but they are no different from anybody else when it comes to the effects of the shutdown.
The government shutdown has put Washington's paralysis on full display, but if you want more reinforcement of just how dysfunctional the nation's capital has become, you might want to read Mark Leibovich's best-selling book, This Town. Leibovich is the chief national correspondent for the New York Times Magazine, a former reporter for the Washington Post, and now best-selling author. He has lived and worked in D.C. for 16 years and is a self-described insider. He's in Missoula to deliver tonight's presidential lecture at the University of Montana. In this feature interview, Leibovich talks with news director Sally Mock about why he wanted to write the book that describes D.C. as a, quote, crucible of easy wealth and fame.
I guess the moment I decided to write the book was in 2008 when I was sitting in the memorial service for Tim Russert, who is this giant of a newsman who died in the
prime
of
Meet the Press.
Host of Meet the Press, the longest running television show in history. And I was at his memorial service at the Kennedy Center, and all of the tribes were there, the Democrats, the Republicans, the lobbyists, the media people, the Clintons, the Obamas, the McCains, the Bushes. And I was just struck by how everyone was treating the event like a cocktail party. Everyone was angling for the next interview or giving out business cards or trying to angle for the next job.
And
Working the room, doing a classic Washington thing. But this was memorial service. And I remember at that moment thinking, this was a time that I wanted to step back and sort of chart what this culture has become. And Washington has always been a place for opportunists. It's been a place for opportunity. It's been a place for people working it. But I thought that this had reached a tipping point of self-celebration, and there was this great disconnect between what we were seeing in the Capitol and what we were seeing elsewhere.
I think outside of Washington and Montana and elsewhere in the country, we think it's a town of stark differences. Mm-hmm. But your book points out that it's really people are all too similar. They're part of what you call the club.
Very, very much so. I think the distinction I would draw is not so much between liberals and conservatives, Democrats and Republicans, but really people who are in the club, insiders, and people who are outside, people who are everywhere else. And what you see in Washington is this permanent feudal class. That's a term that a very conservative Republican, Tom Coburn, coined. And that refers to this culture of self-perpetuation, where staying in the job or building your portfolio in the job or getting the next lobbying job after you're voted off out of office becomes the defining imperative of your existence there. And it becomes sort of a self-service game as opposed to a public service game. And not game. I mean, it is sort of what defines you after a while. And look, I mean, there is any number of data points in the book and elsewhere to indicate that people just want to stay on the inside, and that's more important than serving their country.
Mm-hmm. You call it branding, and the importance of branding yourself.
Branding yourself. No, I mean, I think I ran across a statistic that's in the book, but people really have seized on it, which is that 50% of all U.S. senators, once they're voted out of office, go on to become lobbyists now. That figure compares to 3% in 1974. That indicates to me that this is a professional class of politicians. These are people who want to stay in the game. I mean, George Washington stayed his terms in office and he returned to his farm. I mean, the founders envisioned a system where people would serve their time and then return and immerse themselves in the community. And that's just not the case anymore. There's this sense that if you're elected to office, if you get to Washington, you've punched this lottery ticket that will enable you to cash in on that title or that former title forever.
You also talk about how there's really no such thing as failure, that there's always a second act, and you call it failing upward.
Yes. No, I mean, it's true. I mean, there's really no fall from grace anymore. I mean, even if you look at even the most perverse cases like Anthony Weiner at this point or Elliot Spitzer, I mean, they're going to be fine. I mean, they'll get great consulting jobs. The unemployment line in politics is very, very short. And there are a lot of people who I characterize in this book as people who had, you know, fairly middling runs in office or in their jobs and who have been, you know, cashing in on their former status for a long time. I mean, Robert Gibbs, who was the White House press secretary for the first 2 years of the Obama administration, has made, you know, about $2 million in paid speeches alone since he left the White House, which is fine. I mean, it's his right to earn a living, but it's just it gets to a level of money in the political system and the celebrity emphasis that's really, I think, transformed this system.
For me, some of the more alarming parts of the book have to do with journalism and the cozy relationship between newsmakers and journalists in D.C.
Right.
Andrea Mitchell is one of the examples you use. She's, of course, married to Alan Greenspan and hardworking journalist, but...
Yes. Well, I mean, look, I mean, Andrea Mitchell is a terrific journalist, but it's you do realize that everyone is... The social, personal, and professional habitats that people operate in overlap considerably. And another reason I decided to write this town was, as an inhabitant of this town, you see the same people cross-pollinating in every single venue over and over and over again. And what happens is, I mean, there's this thing called the green room, which if you've ever been on a television show or any kind of – it's a waiting room essentially on a TV show. And you have these people who are yelling at each other on television – going into the green room before and after, and essentially sometimes striking business deals, striking these partnerships. I mean, I think a great example of is Terry McAuliffe, who's a longtime Democratic fundraiser and former head of the Democratic National Committee. Running for governor of Virginia. Probably going to win. And Ed Gillespie, who is his counterpart in the Republican National Committee. They would argue with each other all the time, and then they would sort of become friends in the green room, and then they decided to take their dog and pony show on the road, and they're getting $50,000 to debate, you know, before live audiences like it's some kind of professional wrestling match. And again, that's sort of part of the system now too.
You say, quote, punditry has replaced journalism as the highest calling.
It has, in my profession at least. I mean, I came into the business, and I think a lot of my colleagues came into the business just with if not a passion for anonymity, certainly we were taught that, look, reporting is what we do. We are not supposed to be the story. And what you've seen in the last few decades is a premium placed on who can yell the loudest, who can get on TV, who can be a celebrity. And that's what's going to get you paid, and that's what's going to get you noticed. And that's another, I think, unfortunate fact of what we have now. And another, you know, this book also runs through this explosion in new media where anyone with a Twitter feed or a Facebook page can actually build their own brand and just sort of become famous in this electronic space that has nothing to do with serving your community or even just hands-on journalism.
Or facts, for that matter.
Well, there's that too. Yeah, let's not overlook facts.
You talk about, I think it's a snowflake news.
No, snowflake news is what I call just the phenomena of news that is just like a snowflake, dazzling, and you sort of watch it and it transfixes people for a few seconds, and then all of a sudden it just dissolves into nothing when it hits the ground. And we have now in Washington this echo chamber where people just become fixated on the news of the day, whatever is in Politico, which is this new political sort of website that sort of fancies itself like an ESPN for politics. And these echo chamber vehicles, which because of the new technology, it just happens so fast. And it's just forgotten so fast. And I think it has definitely come at the expense of depth, memory, context, and again, the things that we were taught as journalists a long time ago to value.
You profile in the book, and you have profiled him in the magazine as well, in the New York Times Magazine, Mike Allen, who writes for Politico. Mike Allen outside of D.C. in Montana, for example, is unknown.
That's true. He is.
And he's one of the most powerful
people. I argued, the most influential journalist in Washington. I mean, Mike Allen writes this very influential daily email to about 100,000 influencers, he calls them. These are people who are mainly on the coasts, and, you know, Washington and New York especially. A lot of them book television shows. A lot of them are editors in the newspaper. A lot of them are other reporters. And basically, Mike picks and chooses what he thinks is important to emphasize. And
it becomes that.
And it becomes that. And you can just see what's in the email newsletter. And I just read it myself. It came in this morning when I woke up. Defines quite a bit of what's on TV that day and so forth. And Mike is this very quirky character. He's very nocturnal. He doesn't sleep. He's extremely private. And I profile him in the book. But he is ultimately an extremely powerful but yes, very unknown force outside of his realm.
The context of the shutdown in your book is you could not have planned this in terms of
great
it playing
promotion.
Out. No kidding.
Yeah, all things being equal, I would like the government to start. But if it cost me a few sales here, I think I'm willing to serve my country in that way if it gets the government back together again. But no, I mean, look, and I think the underlying premise of this book, and look, people outside of Washington have been both, I think, entertained and appalled by what's been in this book. And that's great. I think that's an appropriate reaction. I think entertaining, fun, you know, I think that's good. But this is a very serious and many have said, and I think rightly, appalling picture that I draw. And again, self-service, right? I mean, if you think about what's driving this government shutdown now, you think of a system that now rewards appealing to the extremes, getting attention, getting media attention. Who's the single most, arguably the single most force, you know, other than maybe the president and the speaker in Washington right now is Ted Cruz. Ted Cruz was elected to the Senate less than a year ago. Okay. Ted Cruz doesn't care that he's in no danger of being voted out. He actually doesn't care. He cares about probably running for president in Iowa in 2.5 years. And that constituency loves him, the Tea Party that is going to drive the Iowa caucuses more than anything. He does not care that his Republican colleagues despise him. He does not care about having accomplished anything collaboratively in the Senate, which theoretically is what people used to value not that long ago, and you would hope most public servants value. But because of this system and the reward system that we've put in place, Ted Cruz is a phenomenon, and there's probably no one more powerful in the Senate right now than him. And again, I mean, I think we've put in place a system where we're getting attention and non-collaboration and non-cooperation has become the premium because it fits in with the whole food fight mentality that animates this book, but also animates Washington in a big way today.
The book is called This Town, and I have been speaking with the author, Mark Leibovich, who's also the chief national correspondent for the New York Times Magazine. I highly recommend the book for people who want to get even more insight into how our capital is functioning or not functioning these days. Mark, thank you so much. Great fun.
Thanks, Sally. I appreciate it.
Journalist Mark Leibovich will give a free public lecture tonight at 8 o'clock in the Denison Theater on the University of Montana campus. His talk is titled, How Self-Service Has Replaced Public Service in the Gilded Capital.
Now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide tonight, look for partly cloudy skies with some patchy fog and lows in the upper 20s to mid-30s. Tomorrow, expect mostly cloudy skies with a slight chance of rain and some patchy fog, as well as highs in the 50s. Central Montana tonight will be partly cloudy with isolated rain and lows 30 to 35 degrees. Tomorrow calls for mostly cloudy skies with a slight chance of rain and highs in the 50s. Southwest Montana tonight, watch for increasing clouds, bringing some isolated rain and snow showers through the night and lows 30 to 35 degrees. Tomorrow, expect mostly cloudy skies with a chance of rain and snow and highs in the 50s. And now for the editorial comments of Mark Hansen.
If you think the current standoff in Congress over the government shutdown is the failure equally of both sides to negotiate a compromise, suppose the party roles were reversed. A Republican president is confronted by a Democratic House Speaker whose most liberal party wing refuses to fund the government unless the president agrees to a single-payer, government-funded health care system. We all know Republicans would howl that this is government by extortion, which it is. Give a minority the laws it wants, or everybody suffers. If President Obama gives in to current demands, this type of scenario is in our future. So our standoff is not ultimately about House demands to suspend the Affordable Care Act. It's about how to govern. Specifically, it is about two very crucial aspects of our democracy. First, the standoff represents a threat to democracy itself, including the fundamental principle on which it is based, the presumption of majority rule. Tea Party Republicans have every right to call for changes to the Affordable Care Act as it moves ahead. But now they are doing nothing less than holding the economic health of the whole country hostage to their demands to stop a bill that was passed by a majority in Congress and signed into law by a president twice elected by a majority. Extortion is a spit in the eye of good governance. This very point should settle the argument. It is true, however, that the presumption in favor of majority rule alone may not always be decisive, for sometimes majorities favor policies that we should nevertheless oppose. What if, for example, a majority favored unjust discrimination against a minority? This brings us to the second aspect of our democracy at stake here, namely, what it should really mean to be a representative of the people. In an argument written in 1788 to convince New Yorkers to ratify the U.S. Constitution, James Madison argued that a representative form of democracy is necessary to control the mischief of factions. By factions, Madison meant those groups, representing a minority or majority, whose passions oppose individual rights or the common good. I would argue, therefore, that any group that shuts down government services and opposes health care to satisfy its particular interests is a faction. Since factions are the result of our tendency to privilege our own interests over others, Madison argued that we should control them by a government of elected representatives. How does this solve the problem of factions? Madison believed that the positions of factions be passed through representatives, quote, whose wisdom may best discern the true interest of their country, and whose patriotism and love of justice will be least likely to sacrifice it to temporary or partial interests, end quote. This body of representatives should be of such number that they are forced to represent a diverse citizenry, inhibiting them from being beholden to factional interests only. In short, the role of an elected representative is to love justice and exercise wise judgment in relation to protecting individual rights and to the common good of the country, and not be beholden to factions. Such a view stands in sharp contrast to how many representatives pursue their jobs today. A congressman should not simply claim, for example, that more citizens voted for him rather than for President Obama, so therefore he should oppose the Affordable Care Act or any other of the president's policies. The views of citizenries are more complex than that. As Montana shows, some people vote for Republicans and for Democrats for various reasons. Representing a population is not about reading polls at those times when they conveniently support a faction within your party. It is also not about pledging to uphold party principles without compromise. Being a representative means having the capacity to recognize factions, to work with them to, as Madison says, refine and enlarge their views in the interests of the larger community, and if necessary, to resist them, despite what it may mean for one's re-election. This is true bipartisanship. It requires evaluating the factional interests within a district and filtering them through wiser judgments about individual rights and the common good of a diverse population. It demands reasoned debate about what is just, and it is about compromise. The exception is compromising good democracy itself, as the U.S. House of Representatives is now doing. That is something we all should oppose. This is Mark Hansen, guest commentator for the Mansfield Program in Ethics and Public Affairs at the University of Montana.
Mark Hansen is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also achieved on our website. I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Valentine. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.